This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
So we'll start with a question from Brian Russell, and that is, we recently had a great family day out at Jodrell Bank, but one question we left with was, how do neutron stars get their magnetic field? It can't be from charged particles being swept around by the spin of the star, as pulsars wouldn't exist. The magnetic field would always be aligned with the spin axis.
So as Brian mentioned, when electrons flow and charged particles flow round a star as it rotates, that generates a magnetic field, just like a coil of wire generates a magnetic field. So the way that gets transferred into the pulsar magnetic field is very interesting. So when the supernova goes off, which ends the star's life and begins its new life as a neutron star, the magnetic field doesn't go away, and the magnetic field that's within the central regions of the star stays there, because it's conserved. It doesn't vanish just because that happens and the electrons are still flowing. As the star collapses into the much smaller neutron star compared to how big it was before, those field lines are all compressed. There are the same number of magnetic field lines, but they're all compressed into a much, much smaller area as the star shrinks. So that's why there's a much stronger magnetic field in the neutron star as there was an original star, basically because all the magnetic lines are all squashed and compressed to much higher density. The reason that spin axis doesn't align the magnetic field of the star is that there's a massive kick. When the supernova goes off, there's a huge kick on the star. The force of the explosion, which is very rarely perfectly symmetric, it tends to kind of trigger on one side or the other, and that means that it pushes the axes off. So the magnetic field stays in the old axis that it was. The spin axis rotates to the new one given by the kick.
Our next question is from Simon Lackinger, and that is, does E equals HF mean only discrete frequencies are possible?
Yes and no. So the question's about photons and their energy and their frequency. This relation, quantum mechanical discovery, connects the frequency of a photon to the energy of that photon and says they're just proportional, Planck's constant as the constant of proportionality. So that's saying that, you know, when you have a single particle, light, a photon, you know its frequency, you know its energy. Now, what Simon's asking about is the fact we do find energy levels in atoms. Atoms have discrete energy levels. The electrons going round atoms have discrete levels. They don't go anywhere between the atom and the outside world. They have very fixed orbits, which are kind of derived from quantum mechanics. And it's transitions between those orbits which give you discrete frequencies that atoms emit at. So the general answer to the question is that no, photons, particles of light, can have any frequency they want to and any energy they want to. You know, there's a whole continuum of these things. But in the specific case of photons emitting from atoms, there are certain discrete frequencies. So you can get other frequencies if the electron manages to escape completely when it jumps around in the atom. But if the electron, which is the case most of the time, jumps between these discrete standard energy levels in an atom, that emits at standard energies or discrete energy levels. And that means we do see discrete frequencies of light coming from excited atoms, you know, emission from hot gas. Now, that's got very important astrophysical consequences. One of the big things that you can really see in the universe and one of the big mechanisms of emission is called emission lines. So when we look at the spectrum of lots of different kinds of objects, we see lots of continuum emission, so lots of emission of light with a broad range of frequencies, but spikes, very bright emissions of energy and emissions of photons at particular frequencies that correspond to the chemistry of what's going on in the atom. So, for example, we can see all across the universe the hydrogen lines, which correspond to transitions within hydrogen, so very specific frequencies that we can detect from atomic emission. And these are important because they provide the core of spectroscopy, so that's how we study both the chemistry and the composition of stars and galaxies, and also of redshift. Because these are discrete lines and we know where they are, we can tell if they've been redshifted or Doppler shift as the universe expands. So these lines form the core of our understanding of how the universe is expanding.
Our final question comes from John Brooks, and it is, how can astrophysicists weigh a black hole when we can't even see or detect them directly? Is the weight an estimate of its estimated size? If so, then how could they possibly estimate a density or weight of a singularity material without direct interactions?
So it's important to distinguish two things. First of all, we don't make any claim about the mass or the density or these properties of the singularity of a black hole. So the singularity of a black hole is what's right in its core, and that's totally inaccessible to observations. All the things we know about that have to come from theory and understanding from the theoretical properties of black holes. So we're not saying anything about the singularity itself. What we're talking about is the whole black hole, so everything within the event horizon of the black hole. And John is absolutely right that we can't measure those things directly. Black holes are just too small for us to directly see them and measure their properties, and they're also black, hence the name. So we can't do anything directly. So all our evidence is kind of a little bit indirect. The main way we understand the mass of black holes is through dynamics. So we can look at the effect of the black hole on things around it. So the gravitational effect of the black hole on its surroundings. So that's both on stars, sort of individual objects, and there's a beautiful example of this in the centre of our galaxy. The Milky Way black hole can be seen, not directly, but we can see its effect on stars which kind of orbit around it. And we can see these stars, you know, going in a perfectly straight line and then whizzing round in a new direction as the invisible black hole perturbs their motion. So we can see that kind of thing. So we can tell the mass there from the gravity. And secondly, we can see it in a kind of more general way in active galactic nuclei. So that's black hole in the centre of distant galaxies with surrounding them a disk of material gradually flowing into them and orbiting it and then falling into the black hole. So in that situation, we're looking at the dynamics of a whole continuous region, not just individual stars. So we can see that material going around, and we can actually map it very, very cleverly using a technique called a reverberation mapping, where we look at reflections from that material of light on different parts of it. So as something falls into the black hole and gives a little flash, we can see the reflections of that flash from all the material going around the black hole. So that from that, we can make sort of maps of the region around a black hole, and therefore a map of how those things are moving. And when we've got the motions and dynamics, we can use that information to tell us about the mass of the black hole itself. There's one other way, which is pretty cool, which is gravitational redshift. So when photons are emitted from material which is in a gravitational field, then they are redshifted just as they are when they're emitted by moving objects. And we can use that gravitational redshift to map the gravity of black holes, and that tells us the mass. John had one other question, which I'll cover briefly, which is the mass of a black hole related to its size? And the answer is yes. And for a given mass black hole, there's exactly one size it can have. There's a very distinct relation between those two things, and which comes directly from general relativity. That's at least true for a heavily round Schwarzschild black hole, as they're called. So yes, we're measuring both the size and the mass when we do these measurements.